order you directly, yes. Right? How do you know?
Well, you know, personally, on a personal basement, I would say that there is a feeling in your heart that you would understand if you are going in the right way, or no, you are just running out of line or just going through the wrong way. But if you are doing everything based on what Ahlul Bayt has said, and if you are doing whatever that you're doing based on the Holy Quran, then that seems you're on the right track.
Yeah. I thought you were going to go off the track, but then you came back right on where I wanted it.
No, you know what I was going to mention? That was the fitra, you know what I mean? The soul knows what is the truth. It has been put inside of us. Each one of us knows what is true and what is wrong.
Yeah.
The thing is that just after we grow up,
if you are way too deviated,
there's certain curtains that happen into our
heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're way too deviated, not way too deviated, but even certain actions that we perform, I might not be able to decipher between the right and wrong because you know, it's been veiled, as you said, right? Mm-hmm. Why go to your neighbor's house or why go to the other city when at home you've got these role models, right?
Yes.
Everything has been provided
Why
to us.
Why to search for the thing you have in your heart somewhere else?
Exactly.
And
Imam Ali says, you think you're a very small being, creature, whereas the greater universe lies within you. And Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wasalam, these are the role models that we have. And what they've done, we should do. What they've not done, we should abstain from, right? One of the problems that we have, you know, nothing good, right, comes easy.
Exactly.
Right?
That's a way of life.
This is what we need to understand as youth, that if someone's going to tell you, listen, I'm going to give you a shortcut to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, turn around.
Exactly.
Turn around. Yeah, that's not going to happen. But is it going to happen? Am I going to feel Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala within this life before I die? Why not? We've got the narration of Haritha. When he comes to the Prophet, peace be upon him, he's pale. And the Prophet, peace be upon him, says, how was your morning? And he said, I woke up with certainty. And he said, I woke up with certainty as if I saw the throne of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Yeah.
And how did he get into that point?
Following the footsteps of the Prophet, peace be upon him. Right. Mm-hmm. At that time, the Prophet was there with him. Right. We, unfortunately, do not have that, but we do have our narrations, we do have our traditions.
Yes, we have a heritage behind us.
Yeah,
we can follow all those heritage that are right, and we have also scholars who can show us the way.
So I think, yeah, that the best way is to follow the footsteps of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, and not expect something in return.
Exactly. Talking about metaphysical stories and groups that are happening right now, and they're very much viral these days in the modern life. We could see them through the media or anywhere you could see them and find them. But the thing is that most of them are doing that based on a fraud. They're deceiving other people. They're using whatever they know about your personality, whatever they know about your character and your needs against you. So in order not to get out of the true track, out of the true things you have to do, then you should follow Ahlul Bayt and the Holy Quran, whatever that has been told to us, in order to achieve prosperity.
Yeah, deception, illusions, yeah, they do exist. We do a very famous story of the person who came to Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. Do you remember the story with the egg? He came to Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and people were very astonished by this guy's metaphysical knowledge and capabilities.
Yeah.
And Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, this guy had an egg in his hand, and he asked Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, what do I have in my hand? And Imam Ali tells him, it's insane. This guy opens his hand wide open in front of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and closes his hand, right? And asks Imam Ali alayhi salam, what do I have in my hand? And Imam Ali says, he names it a certain egg, a very rare egg,
yes,
that's found on a mountain, mm-hmm, because the bird, it lives on yes, so certain far types of yes topography. And he said, that's what's in your hand. And he opens his hand and it's there. And he closes it again. And Imam and the guy asks Imam alayhi salam, where is it now? Imam says, it's back where it came from, right?
Oh, yes.
And this guy is mind blown, right?
Why? Astonished, of
yeah,
course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This guy, he's used to people being astonished and mm-hmm surprised at his actions. Now he's lost his mind. He's mm-hmm. How does this guy know, Imam alayhi salam? And Imam says, how do you do it? The guy said that, whatever my heart tells me, I do the opposite. So the guy says, whatever my heart tells me, I do the opposite. Imam says, what does your heart tell you about accepting Islam? And
good question.
Yeah. And he says, it says don't. Imam says, all right, then why do you not accept Islam? And the guy left with no answer. He's like,
he's
I do
speechless.
Yeah, he's speechless.
Yes, exactly.
And he accepts Islam and realizes that what he had is gone now.
Mm-hmm.
The supernatural things that he had,
yes, yes,
they were gone now.
And most of the time, those sort of people get their superpower to doing those supernatural things from the wrong source.
Yeah.
It's the devil who's actually helping them.
Yeah, either that. There's a concept in Islam that says certain things have an effect, mm-hmm, right? One of those things is, as the teachers say, the farther away you are from yourself,
exactly,
right?
Yes.
Less attention you pay to your own self,
mm-hmm,
the more knowledge is going to pour down upon you, right?
Exactly. And those who know too much, I don't believe they would speak too much.
Yeah, they won't show off. Yeah,
exactly.
They won't show off.
Yes. So just to give an answer to the youth who's listening to us, how to ignore those groups and how to find out which is right and which is wrong.
If we are occupied with the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, mm-hmm, trust me, we don't have time. We don't have time for these groups. You know, if we're occupied with...
And we would understand that the very first place they are being wrong.
Yeah, yeah, precisely.
That whatever they're saying is just a mere meditation, perhaps,
yeah,
a practice of meditation.
The true wisdom lies with the Ahlul Bayt alayhi.
Exactly, that is true. Yeah. And which we have got a huge heritage. We could go back to them and find out whatever we need and get it out of those sources.
Yeah, we've seen scholars spend their lives mm-hmm and not even gaining a fraction of the knowledge that has been left with
exactly
us from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wa sallam.
In order for us to get to the truest source that has been remained for us. Thank you. You shared with us some very beautiful stories and informations, of course. This was all that you got with Youth Station. Until another episode, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you all.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
France's 2022 presidential vote is divided into two rounds, a free-for-all and a runoff vote between the top two contenders. 12 candidates ranging from the far right to the far left are running for this election. If a candidate secures over half of the total vote, they will directly win the election, but this hasn't happened since Charles de Gaulle's re-election in 1965. Otherwise, only the top two candidates make it through to the second round, and whoever wins that round will be the new French president for a five-year term. President Emmanuel Macron is seeking to become the first incumbent to win re-election since Jacques Chirac in 2002. He is vowing to continue to decrease taxes, raise the pension age to 65, and get France to full employment after decades of mass joblessness. But Macron entered the race late, and his second term is facing a real threat from far-right candidate Marine Le Pen, as polls show a closing of the gap between the incumbent and his main rival. Le Pen was the runner-up in the 2017 elections. This will be her third attempt at the presidency. She's a key far-right figure and the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen, who founded France's National Front and is notorious for his racist, anti-immigrant views. Le Pen has focused on the cost of living crisis, while her anti-immigration program would ban the Muslim headscarf from all public places. Voters have complained of a lack of new political ideas or vision, and few solutions to their problems, including purchasing power and the high cost of living, healthcare, and the fight against climate change. There have been fewer rallies, and voters have complained there was no direct TV debate between all candidates. As a result, an unprecedented number of French voters say they are unsure who to vote for, particularly young and low-income voters. Voter turnout has decreased from 84% in 2007 to about 78% in 2017, and it is believed that abstention may be even higher this time. A low turnout could have a major impact on the vote. France's 2022 presidential election is unlike the previous ones. That's mainly due to the events that have taken place in the political and social scene of France in recent years and intensified the pressure on minorities such as Muslims and immigrants. For Muslims, the election of Emmanuel Macron was supposed to provide relief after 5 years of François Hollande. However, Macron's first term has been gloomy for French Muslims. Many French Muslims no longer see him as the centrist that he claimed to be in 2017, particularly due to the adoption of the separatism law in the summer of 2021. The government claims its legislation is intended to strengthen France's secular system. Critics, however, say it unfairly singles out the Muslim community and restricts religious freedom. France has been criticized by international organizations and NGOs, especially the UN, for targeting and marginalizing Muslims with the law. Since February 2018, France has controlled nearly 25,000 mosques, schools, associations, and workplaces and closed 718 of them, including over 20 mosques.
France, like many other European and Western nations, is going through ever-increasing Islamophobia and environment of hate against Muslims. And the reality is that this environment is escalating by politicians and by media and by the policies of otherization, i.e. targeting Muslims as the reason and the problems for everything whatsoever.
The alleged centrist Macron has no solution for France's anti-Muslim problems. And in case far-right Le Pen replaces him, things are probably not going to change for the better. Therefore, French Muslims have a choice to make: abstention or taking a chance on a left candidate.
Tel Aviv has been the scene of yet another Palestinian operation. On Thursday, a Palestinian man opened fire at Israelis in the heart of a city, killing three and injuring eight others. He was shot dead by Israeli forces after a nine-hour manhunt. Palestinian resistance groups praised the attack as a heroic operation, calling it a natural response to Israeli crimes. The Popular Resistance Committee, a coalition of a number of armed Palestinian groups, says the operation exposed the regime's fragility and weakness. The comments were echoed by Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah, which hailed the recent shooting operation in Tel Aviv as a legitimate response to crimes committed by the Israeli regime. Thursday's attack was the fourth such operation in the past 2 weeks. Late last month, a Palestinian shooting operation killed 5 people in a Tel Aviv suburb. Attacks in the northern city of Hadera and the southern city of Beersheba had killed 6 Israelis days earlier. But the question is, what's behind the uptick in the number of attacks that's been described as one of the deadliest waves of Palestinian operations in years?
We are suffering daily from their homes being confiscated, their lives being taken, children being arrested on an almost daily basis and taken off to jail. So for every action, there is a reaction, and repression builds resistance. So I think we are seeing an outcry of despair, but also a strengthening of resistance against the continued illegal occupation of the West Bank.
As tensions mount in the occupied territories, Israel is bracing for more Palestinian operations in the days to come. The events that are unfolding in the occupied territories are reminiscent of hostilities that culminated in the 11-day war on Gaza in May last year, during which over 250 Palestinians, including scores of women and children, were killed in the besieged enclave. The international community called for an immediate end to the war, but stopped short of condemning Israel for the deadly and devastating onslaught after it was over. The world also seems to have turned a blind eye to Israel's land grab and expansionist policies that see hundreds of Palestinian-owned structures razed to the ground every year. The years-long blockade on Gaza Strip, settlers' violence against Palestinians, and Israel's illegal settlement construction activities also seem to be going unnoticed. When some Arab states announced the normalization of ties with Israel, they claimed that their moves will help the Palestinian cause. But the events of the past couple of years have shown that the only contribution their newly established ties with Tel Aviv made to Palestinians has been even more suffering.
You've mentioned all the usual suspects who give political coverage and the fig leaf of respectability to the apartheid Israeli regime, remembering that Israel is a white colonial European colonization project within the Middle East. But you've left out the other group of people, the other organization that have condemned Palestinian violence, but have not condemned Israeli violence, and that is the Palestinian Authority, which is led by the unelected Mahmoud Abbas. So while all these other people are held to account for their failure to hold to account Israeli apartheid atrocities and war crimes, let us not forget the PA, Mahmoud Abbas.
In the absence of any accountability, Israel is expected to put even more pressure on the people of Palestine. But the Palestinians are indicating that they remain steadfast to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation with or without international support.
The world will never forget the gruesome killing of outspoken journalist Jamal Khashoggi by a Saudi hit squad in 2018. Khashoggi was strangled at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and then dismembered by a forensic scientist who worked for Saudi intelligence. The killing was caught on listening devices planted by Turkish intelligence. The Saudi dissident's body was then cut to pieces and taken to the Turkish Consul General's residence, where it is believed to have been burned. No remains have ever been found. The brutal murder severely strained ties between Ankara and Riyadh and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish exports. It cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was particularly vociferous in his condemnation of the Saudi government. He said Khashoggi was killed in cold blood by a death squad sent from Riyadh, and that it had been established that his murder was premeditated. The Turkish president said the operation had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government. His assessment was supported by a U.S. intelligence report which said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had personally approved the assassination. There has been almost no doubt that the order to kill came from very high up in the Saudi government. And Turkey was widely seen as the most unrelenting force behind efforts to bring those responsible for the assassination to justice. But Ankara has suddenly changed course. On Thursday, a Turkish court halted the trial of Saudi suspects and transferred the case to Saudi Arabia. The Turkish court's ruling has been widely denounced. Rights groups called the move an appalling whitewash. Khashoggi's Turkish fiancé says she has been surprised and saddened by the decision, which she described as political. Following the court's ruling, Hatice Cengiz said Saudi Arabia is a country where there is no justice and that no one expects a just decision there. She also pledged to appeal the court ruling. The Turkish U-turn on the murder trial comes as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is trying to mend ties with the Saudis. The Khashoggi case has been a major obstacle to warmer political relations between the two sides. But why does Turkey need to reset its ties with the oil-rich kingdom so much? Turkey is grappling with a severe economic downturn, and the Turkish leader is facing an election next year.
I think it has everything to do with trying to mend ties with Saudi Arabia. I think Turkey has been chasing reconciliation with its former antagonist. We've seen that it's reconciled with the UAE. We've seen that it's been making concessions to Egypt, that it's been restricting the activity of Egyptian opposition in Istanbul and telling Egyptian opposition critics in Istanbul to tone down their criticism of Sisi in a bid to try to get Egypt to accept a reconciliation. And likewise, we're seeing Turkey make strenuous efforts in order to convince Mohammed bin Salman to end the Saudi boycott of Turkish goods.
Riyadh had made it clear to Ankara that a thaw could only come if Ankara drops the case against the kingdom. The Turkish court's ruling has left little doubt that cash-strapped Ankara wants a thaw in ties with the wealthy Saudis to such an extent that it is willing to drop the high-profile case for good.
So what Turkey is essentially doing, it's handing the issue over to Saudi Arabia and saying, for us, the matter is closed, and we're going to allow you to close the matter as well permanently so that nobody officially in the international community can talk about Khashoggi anymore.
Saudi petrodollars seem to be once again giving the kingdom impunity for its horrific crimes.
Russia has warned the West against disrupting peace talks with Ukraine. Foreign Minister Lavrov says Russia believes the West is enabling hysteria around the alleged mass killings in the Ukrainian town to derail the peace talks between Moscow and Kiev. We tend to think that the reason lies in the desire to find a reason to disrupt the ongoing negotiations and to do it exactly at the moment when, as they say, the light, even if not bright, but nevertheless began to dawn. According to Lavrov, in the course of negotiations with Russia, Kiev had for the first time put on paper its readiness to declare itself neutral, not aligned to any bloc, and non-nuclear. Lavrov insisted that the Ukrainians had formalized a refusal to deploy the weapons of foreign states on their territory or to conduct exercises there with the participation of a foreign military without the consent of all guarantor states of the future treaty, including Russia. The remarks by the Russian top diplomats highlight the possibility that Ukraine's Western backers may have different motivations or reservations about a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. For some NATO countries, the war between Ukraine and Russia is preferable to a peace deal.
Well, obviously, Ukraine is being utilized by NATO in a very dangerous experiment. And it's not the first time this has happened. This has really been kind of a century-old project dating back to after the First World War, when there was an attempt to prevent the growth of large major countries like Germany and Russia, so that Central Europe has always been used by, in those days, by the British, and these days by the Americans, as a wedge against any major country that might become a competitor.
There is a long track record of influential foreign policy thinkers who suggested America would benefit from Russia fighting an insurgency in Ukraine. The latest official to express the benefits of Ukrainian insurgency is U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Kahl. I think with a high degree of certainty that Russia will emerge from Ukraine weaker than it went into the conflict. Militarily weaker, economically weaker, politically and geopolitically weaker, and more isolated.
Unfortunately, the United States is continuing to work, as they did after World War II in Ukraine, against the Soviet Union, to ally themselves with extremely right-wing forces who earlier had been associated with the Nazis. And that is a real factor in Ukraine. It's undeniable. And the United States is playing with them as a tool in a game against Russia. It's hard to say what the end game there is.
U.S. officials say they are skeptical that the Ukrainian government's negotiations with Russia will lead to a swift deal. And they are considering how a settlement will impact the security of NATO nations. Some European countries, especially formerly communist ones, are especially nervous about how the conflict will evolve. They believe if Russia feels it has profited from the invasion, it may eventually be inspired to try the same thing against other neighbors. NATO leaders say the Ukrainians are involved in a broader fight on behalf of Europe. Even a Ukrainian vow not to join NATO could be a concern for some neighbors. Therefore, it appears that for some in NATO, it's better for the Ukrainians to keep fighting and dying than to achieve peace. They believe the peace deal would come too early or at too high a cost to Kiev and the rest of Europe. European members themselves do not appear united on how much of a direct threat Russia poses to the alliance. Germany and France are more inclined than their allies in Eastern Europe to feel that Moscow's aims stop at the NATO border. For countries that are closer to the war, there is a belief that they have more at stake.
In the limelight.
In the United States, an arbitrator has ruled that two Buffalo police officers did not violate use of force guidelines when they pushed a 75-year-old protester to the ground in June of 2020 during racial injustice protests following the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Associated Press. The piece is titled, Buffalo Police Cleared Over Pushing 75-Year-Old George Floyd Protester. In the United States, an arbitrator has ruled that two Buffalo police officers did not violate use of force guidelines when they pushed a 75-year-old protester to the ground in June of 2020 during racial injustice protests following the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The episode drew national attention when a news crew captured video of Martin Gugino being shoved by police officers Robert McCabe and Aaron Togalski in downtown Buffalo, New York, as crowd control officers in riot gear cleared demonstrators for an 8 p.m. curfew. Martin Gugino pushed backward, started bleeding after hitting his head on the pavement. He spent about a month in hospital with a fractured skull and brain injury. In a decision on Friday, 8th of April 2022, arbitrator Jeffrey Selchik wrote, "Upon review, there is no evidence to sustain any claim that respondents, police officers, had any other viable option other than to move Martin Gugino out of the way of their forward movement. The level of force used was justified because Martin Gugino refused to comply with orders to leave the scene and was acting erratically and walked directly in front of Officer McCabe," according to arbitrator Jeffrey Selchik. "The use of force employed by respondents reflected no intent on their part to do more than to move Gugino away from them," he wrote. At the time, Matt D'Alessio, a friend and fellow activist of Martin Gugino and a public defense attorney, told The Guardian, "I know exactly what he was doing. I've seen him do it 100 other times. What I think he was doing was trying to offer them something to read on his phone about the law, about the right of people to assemble peacefully, or asking why they were preventing people from exercising that right." Donald Trump, then president, tweeted out a baseless conspiracy theory, apparently sourced from the cable news outlet OANN, that Gugino could have been an Antifa provocateur and the entire incident could be a setup. Buffalo police suspended police officers McCabe and Togalski without pay, and they were arrested within days of the incident. But charges against them were dropped after a grand jury declined to indict them last year. An attorney for Martin Gugino told the Buffalo News the ruling has no bearing on a lawsuit that they are pursuing against the city of Buffalo. "We are not aware of any case where this arbitrator has ruled against on-duty police officers, so his ruling here, on behalf of the police, was not only expected by us, but was certainly expected by the union and city who selected and paid him," Melissa Wischerath told the newspaper. The Buffalo Police Commissioner, Joseph Gramaglia, said he would reinstate the two police officers to duty on Monday, the newspaper reported. Email messages seeking comment were left with an attorney representing the city of Buffalo, which argued for disciplinary charges, and with the Buffalo Police Union. Friends say Martin Gugino is a longtime follower of the Catholic Worker Movement, a group that advances peace and justice. In the moments before he was pushed to the sidewalk by a Buffalo police officer and then left for dead, the 75-year-old Martin Gugino walked towards the line of advancing police officers. Gugino remained in hospital for about a month due to the serious head injury that he received at the hands of Buffalo police.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the philosophy of fasting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. The month of Ramadan also has a distinct social dimension. The philosophy of fasting, we said, is comprised of two major dimensions. One is the spiritual dimension. The other is more to do with the society and the social dimension of us fasting. When Muslims fast during the daytime of that month, the holy month of Ramadan, they are hungry and thirsty. We all know that. And during that period of hunger and thirst, they can relate more to the suffering of the hungry and the poor people in the community and around the world. Those who fast during the daytime know that after sunset, there will be a meal on their dining table. But they also realize, or should realize at least, that there are many people who fast even when it is not Ramadan. And they fast without the assurance of having a meal on their table at the end of the day. They fast simply because they don't have anything to eat. So see, somebody who fasts during this blessed month of Ramadan, how he becomes courteous and affectionate towards hundreds and thousands and millions of people, one can argue, who don't have food to eat. They don't have guarantee of where they're going to get their next meal from and whether they're going to get it or not. Look at Yemen, for example, today. Yemen is going through such a dire situation that you and I cannot even imagine or begin to imagine. It's the biggest and the most major humanitarian crisis in the world that is taking place because of the wrongdoings of the Saudi regime and their masters, the United States of America and its cohorts. Brothers and sisters, Yemenis are dying of hunger. So if we are in the state of fasting, we can probably relate to them, even if it is just an ounce more than what we can feel at the moment. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the philosophy of fasting, and out of the two dimensions, the spiritual dimension and the social dimension, we're trying to cover the social dimension today. And before the break, we gave you the example of Yemenis who are going through a humanitarian crisis. They are starving. Many kids, mothers, fathers, elderly people, they're starving to death. They are starving because they don't have food to eat, and ultimately they pass away from this world just because they don't have a loaf of bread to eat. Now, if we are fasting, we can probably relate a little bit more and have a little bit more compassion and affection towards these Yemenis. Similarly, and Yemen is just one example, similarly there are Palestinians, there are many other refugees throughout the world who are dying of hunger because they don't have adequate food to eat. If somebody is fasting, they would relate more to these people. Although, let me say this, it's not even going to be close to realizing the severity of the issue. Because at the end of the day, even if we are fasting, we know at the sunset we're going to have a good iftar and a good meal that is going to fill us up till the next fast. The realization, this realization stimulates the element of charity and sharing in human beings. In this sense, the month of Ramadan is also a month of sharing and charity. At end of the fasting month, Muslims have a major feast known as Eid al-Fitr, when they gather in the mosque for special prayers and celebrations. However, before Muslims go for the special prayers, they are required to pay Zakat al-Fitr, which is a special charity. This is like the first step which God, the Almighty, is helping us to take on the path of charity and sharing, with the hope that Muslims will continue to share what God has given to them with the less fortunate members of the society. So see, the social dimension of fasting is very beneficial for the human society. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
In the first quarter of 2022, China is expected to take 65% of the global market in new energy vehicles. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Juan Cole, journalist. This article is published under the heading, As U.S. Funds Pentagon Bloat, China investments in green energy soar. Here's more. China is defeating the United States of America in the burgeoning new energy vehicle market, outproducing and outselling America with regard to plug-in vehicles by a massive margin. Whereas the Chinese government is supporting this new industry, the United States government is still subsidizing fossil fuels and is spending $728.5 billion a year on the Pentagon at a time when the U.S. is not even at war. The result is bloated and problematic engines of destruction like the failed F-35. In 2021, about 4 million EVs were produced around the world. That year, China made 57.4% of them. In the first quarter of 2022, China is expected to take 65% of the global market in new energy vehicles, according to Yang Yang at China Daily. China exported about 500,000 new energy cars in 2021, 2.6 times more than the previous year. China's EV exports to Europe rose fivefold to 230,000 units, right? Akashi Kawami at Nikkei Asia. You know whose EV exports to Europe did not increase 5 times in 2021? America's. In contrast, the U.S. automakers accounted for just 12% of global EV sales in 2021, and Nikkei Asia says, worse, the U.S. lost market share in this sector compared to 2020. We are not only not at the forefront of this industry, we are falling behind, an American expert said. The U.S. Republican Party and their plus one, Senator Joe Manchin, are preventing the U.S. from becoming the dominant automaker in the world in this decade by consistently shooting down the green energy and transportation provisions of the now moribund Build Back Better bill backed by Joe Biden. The major Chinese automaker, BYD, announced recently that it now no longer even produces gasoline-driven vehicles using internal combustion engines, ICE. The U.S. looks increasingly like a backward, lumbering dinosaur in this new green technological environment. Inside China, EVs had been 6% of new vehicle purchases at the beginning of 2021, but it skyrocketed to 22% by the end of the last year. That is an increase of 1.3% a month every month, Yang points out. In absolute numbers, in January 2021, China sold 173,000 new energy cars. In January 2022, 372,615 new plug-in vehicles were registered. That is more than double, 115%. This is incredible. In 2021, about 4 million EVs were produced around the world. That year, China made 57.4% of them. This year, its market share is increasing significantly. Chinese firms are defeating formerly Japanese-dominated car markets such as Thailand, Nikkei Asia says. The country's largest producer of automobiles, SAIC Motor, sells its MGEP new energy car in Thailand for 30% less than the price of a Nissan Leaf EV.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. Today, the enemy's challenge with the camp of the truth is not easy, rather it is a difficult task. That is why they have resorted to a soft war and they are doing their best to pollute minds. This is due to our power and strength. I said that outstanding personalities have been targeted, but among them there are thankfully a large number of groups, seminarian and academic, who are insightful and motivated and who can be a solid pillar and source of support in the true sense of the word. Of course, the enemy is busy working very hard. He is busy influencing and infiltrating in a very serious manner. Well, what should we do now in the face of this move of the enemy? We should engage in the jihad of clarification. This is what you frequently discuss in your speeches in the past couple of days. I, too, have discussed the jihad of clarification several times. Why do we call it jihad of clarification? This is derived from the Commander of the Faithful's words. In his well-known testament to Imam Hassan alayhi salam and Imam Hussein alayhi salam, which is addressed to them, but we, too, are also addressed as the Imams say. I advise you both, and all my children, and members of the family, and everyone whom my writing reaches. One of the things that he says is, fear Allah and keep Allah in view in the matter of jihad, with the help of your property, lives, and tongue in the way of Allah. Nahjul Balagha, The Peak of Eloquence, Letter 47.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
This is a jihad with tongues. Fortunately, the people who had the power to do so among our nation did jihad with the help of their property and lives. In the present time, too, they are engaged in jihad, but one must do jihad with the help of tongues as well. Those who can should be active and do jihad in this regard as well. I have spoken at length about the jihad of clarification. Today, too, I will raise a few points that might not have been raised until now. One point that must be made sooner than the others is that I have heard that the Parliament has allocated a heavy budget to the jihad of clarification. I'm not really all right with such ways of treating the matter.
Allah, I wanna thank you. That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A glimpse into Iran's capabilities in the nuclear industry. This exhibition showcases the latest made-in-Iran nuclear products, ranging from radiopharmaceuticals to plasma therapy for cancer patients. Among them is Gallophabi, a radiomedicine used in the efficient diagnosis of cancer. Its developers say it is an outstanding achievement in the nuclear sector. For security reasons, we cannot show the experts' faces. The exhibition comes as part of ceremonies marking the National Day of Nuclear Technology, which falls on April 9th. It commemorates Iran's first enrichment of uranium at an industrial scale in 2006. In addition to the 77 new achievements displayed here, on Saturday, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi unveiled what he called a comprehensive strategic document for nuclear development. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the document provides a roadmap for the country's nuclear program in the next two decades. Since Iran indigenized its nuclear industry, it has always been haunted by sanctions. In 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, was signed between Iran and the world powers, which promised a sanctions relief for the country in return for curbs on its nuclear program. The U.S. left the accord in 2018 and reinstated its sanctions, prompting Iran to retaliate by scaling back its commitments to the JCPOA. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal have been engaged in the Vienna talks to salvage the accord. The discussions envisage the removal of all sanctions against Iran in return for the country coming back to full compliance with the agreement.
By displaying these nuclear products, Iran tries to show the West that sanctions have not been an obstacle to its nuclear ambitions. At the same time, it wants to tell the JCPOA parties that Tehran will continue to develop its nuclear industry even beyond the JCPOA limits if sanctions are not removed. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The first round of the French presidential election is finished, and as expected, there will be a repeat of 2017. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen will duel once again in the second round of voting.
Maybe the French people will surprise everyone and elect Marine Le Pen. This is her second time making it to the second round, and maybe people will give her a chance. But I think Macron will win because too many people are either scared to vote for Le Pen or feel they will be disappointed by her.
I think Macron is brilliant and that he has handled the coronavirus crisis very well. Le Pen is too racist and too extreme right.
Macron's team brushed off recent polls that actually have Le Pen winning in the second round, as she has soared in the last month to make the race a dead heat. In a close third place, just 1% behind Le Pen, was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former Socialist Party minister who turned left. In a bid to win over centrists, he didn't embrace the yellow vests, and barring a huge cache of votes somewhere, he's headed home and perhaps has aged out of politics. In fourth place, with a disappointing 7%, was mainstream media pundit Eric Zemmour, who was seemingly given control of the campaign agenda for months, despite setting new lows in Islamophobia and racism. The mainstream conservative candidate, Valérie Pécresse, was a distant fifth. The so-called Sarkozyist candidate didn't even get the endorsement of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. The once mighty Socialist Party might be finished after garnering less than 2%, and only the two communist candidates scored less. Finishing a surprising seventh was Jean Lassalle, the only MP to wear a yellow vest in French Parliament. Parliament immediately suspended itself, and Lassalle was fined.
Is Le Pen still so shocking after 5 years of Macronism and in a post-Donald Trump world? Has Macron provided enough stability in a post-coronavirus landscape?